afternoon, everyone.
I guess we got the last session of the day here, so we'll try to keep this thing on time or hopefully finish early. Our moderator was unable to make it today. My name is Paul Cohen. I am the managing actuary at Utica National Insurance in upstate New York. Basically, my primary function has been building and implementing predictive models for both commercial lines and personal lines. Basically, today I'm going to take you through mostly a commercial lines practice. The latest models we've implemented have been commercial lines models, and we've done those over the last, I'd say, 2 years or so, really when the market was truly at the softening stages. And encountered a lot of different challenges that, at least in my prior experience talking with other carriers, maybe were things that were not so elevated in the hard markets when you were implementing models. When I'm done, Mo Masood from Deloitte Consulting, he's a senior manager at Deloitte Consulting, is going to speak more about some management reports and implementation issues, and he'll be joined also by Stacy Peterson, who's also a consultant with Deloitte Consulting. There's the antitrust notice. They told us we need it. Okay, so first I just want to do a little level setting on the soft market versus the hard market. What's up here are really characteristics that we're all familiar with. Most of us here have probably been through at least one market cycle and have experienced the rising and falling profitability. Corporate strategies definitely have to change depending on where you are in different market cycles. What I really want to focus on is a scenario playing out sort of towards the end of a soft market. As the prices tend to bottom out in a soft market, industry profits fall below acceptable levels, which of course helps to trigger price increases. Carriers who maintain good capital strength throughout the entire soft market are able to capitalize on the rising prices once the hard market hits, and they're able to grow in both premium and in policy count. Carriers whose capital position was severely weakened during the soft market, as is somewhat common, they must focus more on re-underwriting their current book of business, and really they end up sending business back into the marketplace, which is then gobbled up by the carriers who actually have a stronger capital position. Now, regardless of the market cycle you're in, all carriers have some sort of growth goal, whether it be premium or PIF or both. So the real question here is how does one navigate through the soft market efficiently so that they are in a strong capital position to gain on the benefits that the hard market will offer us. So I just want to describe a few soft market challenges. As I mentioned, every carrier has some sort of a goal to grow business. Barring new entries into the world, really, the marketplace is pretty stable. There's a sort of a fixed number of risks each year that you can compete for. To grow your PIF basically means that you're taking policies away from another carrier. Obviously, you want to be the carrier that's actually growing your PIF, not the one that's losing their PIF. In order to grow PIF, you generally need to lower your prices. The carrier where the policy is currently at is going to offer a premium, and you're going to need to come in 5, 10, whatever it takes below that to entice that risk over to your company. Anytime you're taking a shrinking premium, of course, your profit margins are going to be shrinking. And that's sort of the true characteristic of what's happening in the soft market. What I'm claiming is really a case is that using predictive analytics will help you navigate through that and go after the risks that you have a better chance at maintaining profitability on, even with the decreasing premiums. The good news is that, although we're all here at this seminar talking about predictive analytics, there's a lot of carriers out there who still are not engaged in predictive analytics. And quite frankly, there's a lot of carriers who are using predictive analytics by building models, but they're not effectively using them and capitalizing on all the benefits they have to offer. In doing so, carriers who can really go after a strategy surrounding predictive analytics can sort of cherry-pick the business from their competitors. And that sort of brings us to the second point here, which is how do you retain your best business without giving away a lot of premium. Obviously, if you're trying to pick off the business from other carriers, it's safe to assume they're trying to pick off your business as well. And we'll talk about some strategies surrounding how you can sort of keep those policies on your books without giving away too much premium. Sort of a very basic scenario is to think about a book of business that's like $1 million book of business, and your average retention rate, let's say, is about 85%. You may have a strategy that says we can decrease premiums in the soft market by 10% and increase our retention from 85 to 90%. The obvious question is that a good strategy? In the first scenario, you can expect about $850,000 in premium. In the second scenario, you expect about $810,000 in premium. That's not saying that the first scenario is necessarily better. There are a lot of things that need to go into that decision process, but things you're going to need to think through. The final point on here is how do you balance the right pricing with competitive pressures? Your marketing folks are going to tell you that there are many markets available in the soft market, and price competition is going to be fierce. They're going to warn that asking for any price increases or even flat premiums on renewals might drive insurers into the marketplace, and really once that happens, the chance of retaining them goes substantially down. You're going to need to adopt several strategies to try to make sure that you are protecting this best business and to also make sure that you are balancing the competitive environment with getting the right pricing. Now, a lot of the presentations here talk about decile management, and I'll show a slide on that as well. And it shows up time and time again that there are always going to be low decile business that is currently overpriced in the market. And that's really where we can balance the right pricing with the competitive pressures. Okay, just a market summary here. I contend that in a hard market, underwriting profits are achievable both by predictive modeling companies and companies that aren't using predictive modeling. In a soft market, I believe it's much more challenging. Modeling-enabled companies are able to identify and select the best business to write, and that's going to allow them to maintain profitability throughout that soft market cycle. Basically, companies that do not use models in the soft market face sort of a double whammy effect. They're going to write less than average risk, and they're going to get those at inadequate premiums. We're going to see a graph. We're going to see a graph in a minute that sort of shows the effect of this for different carriers. So just a very simple example, obviously contrived here. You go through your actuarial process and you figure out that the rate for a pizza shop is $1,500. There are two pizza shops right next to each other. Both look identical to each other. In a soft market, prices get driven all the way down to that $1,500, basically giving no profit overall. While in a hard market, you can write these risks for $2,000. Now, we're just going to say there's two companies. The first company, Company A, engages in predictive modeling and is able to tell which pizza shop is better than the other pizza shop. Company B does not use predictive modeling and really just can't differentiate between the two. So in a hard market scenario, as the actuary in a predictive modeling company, you've identified that really Anthony's Pizza and Gino's Pizza have different costs associated with them. Anthony's Pizza, the cost is really $1,200. Gino's Pizza, the cost is really $1,800. But in the hard market, you know you can charge $2,000. Assuming that you're going to have a 50-50 split of market share, the predictive modeling company is going to write Anthony's Pizza and generate a profit of $800, while the company B, without predictive analytics, is going to write Gino's Pizza and still generate a profit of $200. Really, in the hard market, both companies can find success, but using the analytics will help you maximize your profit margins. Of course, as you go to the soft market and the price decreases to $1,500 for each of these risks, the company that's using analytics and wrote Anthony's is still getting an underwriting profit of $300, whereas the company not using analytics is left with the worse than average risk of Gino's Pizza and generates an underwriting loss here of $300. Now, obviously, in a predictive analytic environment, you're probably not going to really charge the same rate for Anthony's and Gino's, and those are some of the things we'll talk about. So this graph here is a historical graph of operating ratios for what Utica has defined as our peer companies. I didn't have full industry results, although I imagine they're quite similar. The green line represents the entire industry of our peer group, and I just broke these up into A and A minus companies, which is the yellow line, and then A plus and A plus plus companies, which is the red line, as defined by AM Best. And what we see is a few takeaways here. We obviously see the effect of the underwriting cycle playing out from 1998 through the current year. And really, the curves really almost look identical in shape. But what you see is that the A++ and A+ companies, even as the market starts to really generate the higher operating ratios, maintains its sense of profitability. In 2001, when the industry really peaked out at about a 102% operating ratio, or at least according to our peer groups, the A+ and A++ companies were able to maintain an operating ratio below 100, whereas the A and A- companies generated an operating ratio of about 112 points. Now, this is not necessarily a proxy for modeling companies being the red line and non-modeling companies being the yellow line. I really don't have information on who the modeling companies are versus not. I also would say that it's probably not that useful of information. I do believe there's a lot of companies out there, as I mentioned before, which do build predictive models but don't effectively implement them. And that's something that Mo is going to talk more about. I should point out that 2008 numbers are projected numbers based on 9 months' results. And I think they're going to be pretty close to where it actually comes in. We can see that the operating ratio, again, is starting to climb. Sort of, I believe personally that we're peaking out in the soft market, and we're going to soon, you know, hit a hard market again, which I think is different than some of the analyst predictions. Okay, so this graph here is just basically trying to summarize some of the things that I've mentioned so far. We're in a situation here, the bar to the left, has soft market to hard market, and in the middle is the equilibrium. Now, I've defined equilibrium here as when the market is making a profit of 10%. The number is actually not important. It's just to illustrate this. And we're also introducing here the concept of deciles. Again, I think probably most people here have seen deciles in other presentations. And just briefly, you break your business into 10 equal buckets, with decile 1 being the business that performs the best, and decile 10 being the business that performs the worst. Normally, you see a loss ratio chart associated with this in a sort of increasing sloping line. Instead of using loss ratio, I end up using profit ratio by decile, so you have more of a downward sloping line. These profit ratios are actually based on results that we've witnessed over the last year or so. So what I want to point you to is in this market equilibrium position, we have a combined profit of 10%. That's the overall profit ratio. Modeling-enabled companies are generating higher-than-average profits. Non-modeling companies are generating lower-than-average profits, but both are succeeding very well. Now, we can sort of see the effects of scrolling over as rates go up in a hard market, and really what you see is the overall profit ratio for the industry grows, as well as the profit ratio for the modeling versus non-modeling companies. As the market starts to soften, which is really what we're talking about today, when they start getting the rate decreases, the modeling companies are able to maintain a profit ratio, whereas the non-modeling companies are really unable to. When you average all these together, eventually the market gets to a stage where overall they're losing money, and again we start the cycle over going into another hard market. The hardest part about these graphs is getting off of them. Sorry about that. Mo, any ideas on how to get off the graph? Escape, yeah. I'll do that. Just go to the next slide. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so I want to talk about some soft market strategies. A lot of these actually can be employed in the hard market as well, and should be. But I think the issues that you face in a soft market really heighten the need to really look at some of these strategies and make your best attempt to utilize the benefits from them. On a new business side, I'm going to really talk through two strategies. The first thing on here is what I call the cost of new business. I'm going to sort of define that and let you know some of the strategies surrounding how to minimize that cost of new business. And on the renewal side, I'll discuss three specific strategies. So the cost of new business. As we're all aware, the new business generally generates a higher loss ratio than renewal business. This is due to several reasons, one of which being that you have to price it under your competition to draw it away. And two, you know less about the risk than you do as if it was a renewal. So based on that, you tend to run a cost of new business difference, again, comparing the new business loss ratio to the renewal loss ratio. Historically, it averages about 5 points. This actually turns out to be higher in the soft market as you're competing more on price and lower in the hard market. So one of the things we did as we were going through our modeling process was we wanted to evaluate whether or not implementing the models was having an effect on the cost of new business. Now, of course, for the last several years, we've been going through a softening market, and this next chart sort of summarizes what we've experienced. We were trying to build and implement models for several lines of business at once. Of course, we had to take a staggered approach just because of the time involved. So we ended up being able to implement models for certain lines of business, and for other lines of business, they're really just now coming online. What we see is that the cost of new business from the period 2005 through 2007 obviously shows an increasing trend. As price competition gets more fierce, you know, all companies are lowering their premiums, and that cost of new business is actually going up. Now, when we get to 2008, the yellow bar looks like it takes a little dip down, and it does. But if you focus on the red bar, which is the lines that we had not modeled, you can see there's still an increasing trend for the cost of new business for non-modeled lines. Lines where we actually were able to implement models and implement some of the strategies that we're going to work through actually saw a significant decrease from the 2007 cost of new business. It's actually below historical norms of 5%. So we were very, obviously very pleased with that result, and I'm hoping in 2009 that as the non-model lines become model lines, we see similar results there as well. Okay, so just a couple strategies that we work through. And again, you know, you should look at these and say, yeah, these are not really soft market strategies. They're strategies all the time, and that's true. Cross-selling is a great opportunity, both in the hard and soft market, for several reasons. Well, first, just to define it, cross-selling is basically taking a risk that you already have on your books and trying to sell other lines or products to that insured. You may write the workers' comp, but you don't write the BOP or the auto. Now, there's several advantages to cross-selling. First, if you're working with independent agents, which we do, the agent already has control or some control of the account. Obviously, they've already given you the workers' comp, and so they should have access, or at least access to the insurer, to discuss the other lines of business as well. The second advantage to using cross-selling techniques is that the insurance company is already familiar with the insured. You may have run loss control reports for the lines of business that you do write. You certainly know their prior claims and prior billing history with you, and we'll talk a little bit about pre-scoring. I think the loss control for those companies who really are active in loss control is a unique advantage. If you're writing a property for one of your risks and you do a loss control survey on the premises, that loss control survey is going to have a lot of information that is also applicable to other lines of business. For instance, they may identify slip and fall hazards or age and condition of machinery, and those things will obviously help you out somewhat if you're looking to pursue the workers' comp on that account. Of course, knowing the prior claims and prior billing history is always of help. That tells you about the management and what you can expect from them in the future. And then pre-scoring. You already have access to a lot of information about the risk because you have at least one line of business from them, and you can use that to feed into your predictive models for other lines. Now, you may not have all the data you need to accurately and precisely score that account, but you can usually get a pretty good estimate or generate sort of a continuum of estimates, which will allow you to gauge is this a lower decile business or a higher decile business, and is it something you want to pursue? Finally, the risk is already familiar with the insurance company, and that's a unique advantage. They understand potentially your claims handling, if you've had that before. They certainly understand your customer service. It may be a niche class of business that your company specializes in, and you have certain product enhancements and forms that are really specific to that risk. And all of these can really be exploited to your company's benefit. Leads are a little different than cross-selling. Generally, leads are something that you're going after that you don't have any familiarity with yet. You can approach leads from two angles. You can use your existing agencies, or you can look at new agency appointments and how leads would affect that. Lead listings usually all start from the same source. Your underwriting folks may get together and identify certain characteristics that they believe are predictive of what will generate profitable results. It may be certain geographies that you've been successful in, or again, certain classes of business that you've been successful in. Once they sort of narrow down what they want to see, you go out to a vendor, potentially, and ask them to extract all the businesses meeting your criteria. Of course, you send them off to your agents, if that's how you work, is through independent agents, and the agents sort of go from there and try to get the risk into their office and eventually into your office to get a quote. Now, those lead programs have come with sort of mixed success, primarily because the data that you sort of gather from these vendors matching the criteria that you want are only a small portion of the true underwriting criteria that you need. And many of the leads actually come into the door, and when your underwriters finally get to look at them, they say they're not interested. This really aggravates your agents. They feel like they've gone through the work to bring you this insured, and you know, then you're telling them, well, thanks, but no thanks. Predictive analytics can really help you. You can take that external data that you've been buying from your vendors anyways and match it with some other sort of scenario test about, you know, how the risk may actually score when it comes in the door. So then, again, you can't get a precise estimate, but running a few typical scenarios may tell you that these risks are going to score in decile 1 to 3. They're going to be able to give them your best pricing. And if there's a couple things that you didn't contemplate, like the hazard grade or something else, you can just let your agent know. You know, these are the things that we still need to know about the risk before we can give you a firm commitment. But you will end up really increasing your efficiency ratio using the analytics to drive your leads process as opposed to sort of going without the analytics. With new agency appointments, you can still do lead listings, obviously, with any new agency you appoint. But I think you should also use the analytics to help drive your agency appointment strategies. Once you have built the models for each of your lines of business, there's no reason you can't go and score different geographies to see which geographies score better than average, see which target classes score better than average, and really drill in and hone into zip code level. I've heard people today talk about block level data, to really find out where is the business that you really want and that where it matches your company's appetite for whatever classes of business you like to write. Once you've sort of identified those pockets, then you just got to ask yourself the natural questions. Do I already have agents in those areas that can get me this business, or do I need to appoint more? So instead of appointing agents first and then worrying about what business they'll deliver to you, you're appointing agents based on where the business is that you've already identified that you want. So moving on to a couple of renewal strategies, this is the typical decile management graph that is common in many of these sessions. The green zones being the lower decile business, and in every study I've seen, although these are sort of modeling loss ratios, the actual loss ratios really fall into the same buckets. The lower decile business generally are overpriced business. It's business that you have on your books that you could take a premium decrease on if needed. Now, that's not to say you want to go all the way down to the model indicator pricing on all risks, because you're really just giving away premium. You want to try to focus your efforts on which are the risks that are likely to shop, which are the risks that would respond well to like a 5 or 10% decrease and maybe give them a cross-selling ability to go after their other lines that you don't write. But in terms of your retention strategies, it's probably the place where you really want to focus most of your efforts. I don't have the graph with me, but we actually looked at retention rates by decile just to see what it looked like, and it was virtually a straight line across, meaning that our overall retention ratio did not differ by decile. This is sort of in the pre-modeling phase. Don't have numbers yet to see how it's changed, if at all. On the right side of the upper deciles, those are the ones that are likely underpriced. And really, I'm just going to focus on the very right side, the dark red, which I label as the targeted non-renewals. This is the worst 2% of your business. Every company non-renews business every year. And really, the targeted non-renewals is just a shifting of where you're going to non-renew your business. In a study we did on our book, we found the loss ratios for these upper decile business, this last 2%, were generating loss ratios, you know, close to 300%. Now, if you look at your rating scheme, more than likely, you don't have pricing flexibility to get at a 300% loss ratio, even though you may have different tiers and scheduled credits to use. So these are risks that you really can't right price. Now, there may be reasons to keep some of them. It may be the workers' comp that's scoring poorly, but the BOP and auto are scoring great, and on an overall comp basis, it's still profitable. So there may be reasons why you want to keep some of that business. But a lot of them give you an opportunity to sort of non-renew those, maybe hurt a little bit on your PIF retention, but really increase your overall profitability. I'll talk about it a little bit later as well, but you're also creating adverse selection in the marketplace for your competitors. If you don't have the pricing flexibility to right price these accounts, then they probably don't have the pricing flexibility either. Someone's going to write them, and someone's going to lose money on them. You just don't want it to be you. When we did our study as to where we were non-renewing business on average, I believe it came out to be an average decile of about 7. That was good news and bad news. It was good because we were non-renewing worse than average risk. But it was bad because we weren't non-renewing the actually worst risk on our book. So all this is a refocusing your efforts on which business you're going to non-renew. Sort of the vast majority of the risks fall into the yellow and in the first couple red zones where you may be a little bit overpriced or a little bit underpriced, and you'd like to really just get the right price. Now, in a hard market, that's probably something you could pretty easily do. In a soft market, that's a challenge. Even those ones here in decile 6 and 7, which you may need a little bit more premium on, if you try to take that premium, you may lose it. Now, you know, some may say it's a good thing. If you can't get the right price, send it back out to the marketplace, let someone else write it for the wrong price. And, you know, that's true. But there are also strategies that you want to think about, you know, about keeping business, even if it's underpriced, in the soft market, because when the hard market does come, you'll have the opportunity to then right price the account. So is it worthwhile to maintain some PIF at a subsidy so you can right price it later? Now, a lot of that is going to depend on when's the hard market coming. If the hard market's coming in 2015 or 2014, I don't know how many years you can keep this on your books at a subsidized rate, but if it's coming next year or the year after, that may be a sound business strategy. These deciles 4 and 5, where maybe you're just slightly overpriced, really, what you want to do there is just get the renewal done as quick as possible. Don't give them the option to get to the marketplace. If you've got your underwriters working on thousands of accounts, maybe focus their efforts initially on the 4s and 5s, see if you could wrap those up early before the insured even looks at, you know, bringing them back to the agent and getting a new bid on it. Okay, a couple of soft market strategies. These we talked about. The maximized profit is a little different. I'm going to talk about that in a second. We talked about the effect of cross-selling and the targeted non-renewals. So what I want to set up here is we'll just go into a soft market scenario. So we go back to the situation where there's two companies. Okay, one company is modeling, one company is not modeling. Now, just to sort of level set, I'm going all the way back. You see the modeling button says it's off. I'm assuming neither company is using the model at this point. And what you see is across this upper right side, basically the market share is 50-50, and each company has equal percentage of business in each decile. Each one, of course, is generating the same overall loss ratios, in this case of 50%. Since no one is using modeling, no one can distinguish which ones they really should be writing. The loss ratio on the bottom is your typical decile lift curve, and you can just see as you know you go up in decile, the loss ratio goes up. on average, again, it goes down to 50%. Now, when the company who is modeling actually goes and clicks on the modeling scenario, what they're attempting to do here is regenerate their book of business and get the right price. Okay, that means giving premium decreases to the decile 1, 2, and 3 business and giving the premium increases to the upper decile business. What you can see is the market share dramatically shifts. It's more of a downward sloping curve where the modeling company is going to write a lot more in decile 1, 2, and 3 basically because they're going to write that at a lower premium than their competitors, whereas in 8, 9, and 10, they're going to have a very small market share because they're going to price above their competitors. Now, again, they're still going to write business across all deciles for a couple reasons. One, you're not going to turn over your book of business every year. Okay, even if you take price increases, some business is going to stay with you. And you're not going to gain all the decile 1, 2s, and 3s. It's just not feasible. But you'll make a big splash in that. What you can see from the loss ratio standpoint is the non-modeling company loss ratio looks exactly as it did before. Everything got shifted up a little bit because they ended up getting more of the upper decile business and less of the lower decile business. The company that's modeling generates a straight line loss ratio. They're trying to right price every single risk. So I contend this is obviously a good result because the loss ratio goes down to 40% for the modeling company. It was 50. The loss ratio for the non-modeling company goes up to 58%. But there was a negative effect to this as well. Because of the right pricing and getting rid of some of their upper decile business, their market share went down from 50% to 41%. Okay, and you'd like to get some of that back. Now, the first strategy here to try to get some of that back is what I call the maximized profit scenario. And this relates to the sort of decile 1, 2, and 3 business. You can see that the loss ratio for the modeling company is actually higher than the loss ratio for the non-modeling company because they have priced it below the market. You go out on a piece of decile 1 business and offer a rate that's 20% below your competitors, you're going to get that risk. But, of course, your loss ratio will be higher than your competitor would have had if they wrote it. So the question is, what's the magic number? Should you go 20% below your competition? If you went 10% below, would you still get the same risk? So would you not hurt your ability to write the business? What about 5% below? So what's the magic number? I don't have the answer to it, but you got to test different theories on that and play with it. And I think Ian Ayers talked about this morning with different randomized tests. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's the curve is based on a ton of underlying assumptions. The primary one being that what is the reaction in the marketplace if you offer a 2% rate decrease, say, versus a 3% rate increase? Will the insured that you would offer the 3% rate increase to shop or not shop, as opposed to offering them, say, a 10% rate increase? And so we saw sort of flattened out. In fact, it reversed itself a little bit in there based on all the scenarios we ran. I expect that it really should be a little bit more smooth, but it will flatten out in the middle deciles just because of your pricing there is changing not a ton, so you're staying sort of that 50-50 market share. So you're sort of still pricing at the market price level. Yeah, the market share is a lot lower. And again, these are obviously hypothetical numbers, but yeah, it's sticky. They want to stick with you for some reason. Maybe you are a niche market for a certain class of business, and your product enhancements are so far superior to the competition that even with price increases, they're going to stick with you. Now, again, this graph probably would go even lower if you were truly trying to right price everything. Because some of these risks you'd probably be taking 50, 60% increases on, and it's really not feasible. So when we turn on the maximized profit, again, what we're going to do is on the decile 1, 2s, and 3s, we're going to try to price those below the market, but not so far below the market that we're leaving money on the table. The effect of doing that is, of course, to lower your loss ratio for decile 1 to 3, because you're actually getting a little bit more premium on the books. You really haven't hurt your PIF retention at all or your policy count, because you're still running the same risk. In fact, on a premium basis, your market share went up a few points to 43%. Now, we talked about the cross-selling and leads, and we just inserted a gauge here to sort of tell us, you know, what would happen under different success rates for these types of initiatives. And what you see as I'm sort of scrolling over is that your market share really starts to go up as, of course, you are more effective in cross-selling and leads. The other takeaway is, of course, your market share is gaining more in the lower deciles, or it's gaining market share at a higher rate than it is in the upper deciles. For the most part, you're going to be targeting risks that are lower deciles, but there are exceptions. You may have upper decile risks that are part of an account, and on the account basis, you can still right price the entire account. Those sort of strategies will help go a long way to getting back to the written premium that you started at, which was, again, 50% of the market share. Now, the targeted non-renewals, again, these are taking that worst 2% of your book and setting it back in the market and letting someone else write those. Just to show you what happens, really the effect is going to be on the yellow bar, where the non-modeling companies are going to write those at the market price, not the actuarial justified price, and you're going to see their loss ratio quickly start to creep up. Again, you're losing a little bit of market share when you do that because you're getting rid of some business, but the trade-off is you've created an adverse selection for your competitors. Now, I just got to escape again because I don't know how to advance that one. Okay, so just to summarize, some keys to, I think, successful implementation of predictive modeling. One is you need clear vision and strategy. But I really focus more on the vision. Strategies are there to help your company obtain their vision. Actually, a Deloitte employee, was it Michael Rayner, I believe, wrote a book called The Strategy Paradox, where he talks about, you know, the fact that a lot of strategies are very well thought out strategies and they fail. The same strategies that work for some companies fail for other companies. And, you know, people tend to, you know, just sort of throw their hands up and say, I don't know what's going on. The key with the strategy is to avoid that strategy paradox. You're going to have strategies that don't work. And what you need to do is you need to know they're not working. You need to monitor them very quickly, very efficiently, and know when they're not supporting your company's vision. That's something that Mo is going to talk more about a little bit later. Another key is to get your senior management involved right away. Your senior management is going to be the ones really communicating this to the entire company. Why is it important to get involved in predictive analytics, and how is it going to benefit everyone involved? You need their involvement right from the get-go. Keep them involved so that they can help you communicate the message. This is going to cross all lines. It's going to cross various departments, various regional offices, so on and so forth. And their senior management team are the ones who really are going to communicate that. You also need to assemble a multifunctional team. The model building, obviously, is an actuarial exercise, but I really think you need input from the underwriters and from the marketers and IT folks and others. They're going to understand some things about the modeling process that you don't understand in terms of what data they really need to evaluate. You're limited when you're building the models to the data you have and the data you can buy. But the underwriters can bring other items to the table. And keeping them involved early on will help gain their acceptance of the models as well. And they're going to be needed as you implement these models, because we're going to talk about business rules and how important it is to go beyond just the model result and bring it to a new level. So business rules, I'm not going to talk too much about it because I do think it's part of the other implementation stuff that Mo and Stacy will touch on. But again, your rules need to support strategies and support your vision. One of the things we found happen is we built some things into our models that underwriters typically use anyways. I think a common thing to build into commercialized models these days is some sort of financial information, whether it be from Dunn's or Experian or some other credit vendor. Our underwriters actually had been using that information all along. Now, once we built it into the model, we really didn't want our underwriters using it outside of the model, because you get the chance of sort of double counting the effect. So we really had to have business rules that told them, hey, don't even look at financials anymore. We know it was part of your workflow before, but it's not part of your workflow going forward. On the flip side, there are many things that you didn't build into your models that your underwriters still need to use. One of the things that we didn't build into our models, and many companies don't, is an area's proneness to catastrophes. We handle that more through catastrophe models. And so we may have two risks that both score exactly the same, say decile 3, but one's in a cat-prone area and one is not. You need separate business rules as to how you're going to price those. They may generate the same indicated pricing based on the model, but that may not be the pricing you want to send out to the marketplace. You need to really tie these into your policy systems and other IT systems. We talk a lot about straight-through processing, giving the agent the ability to get a quote that's bindable right up front instead of going through the underwriter. Obviously, you can't do that in all your risks. Some are just way too complicated and really need the underwriter to evaluate. But I'd like to free up the underwriter's time to handle those more complex risks, and maybe the small, simple risks can be handled by the model. In order to do that, of course, your model has to be part of all your policy administration systems. You'll have a lot of issues to also talk about with security and data retrieval and how easy it is to use. If you give a good price out there to an agent, but it's a pain in the butt to actually go through your policy system, they're not going to give that policy to you. They're going to go to somebody else. Also, you need to really take on a large initiative to train your regional and line folks on what the model is and how they're going to use it. You sit around in the home office and talk about your vision and all your strategies, but it's really the regional and line people that have to effectively use those strategies. So if you don't get out to them and let them know what you're doing and why, you're not going to have their buy-in, and they're not going to effectively implement all your strategies. We actually spent several months developing our training initiative and traveled around the country to our different offices for a fairly significant two-day training seminar, all the way from what was our corporate vision, what is modeling 101, just giving the basics, then get into the business rules and get into how we need them to execute and how they will be monitored on their execution. And management reports I'll skip over because, again, I know that's something that the Deloitte folks here will talk much more about. And the last thing is really a working model. I don't say the best model. And, in fact, again, this is something out of Ian Ayer's book where he quoted another statistician that said, human judges are not merely worse than optimal regression equations. They are worse than almost any regression equation. And I think that's something really important to keep in mind. When you're building these models, you're not going to build the best model. There's always new data you can bring in, new techniques you can bring in. Models will evolve over time. But don't sit back and wait for the next generation model to get better. Every model, no matter how limited the data was and to build it, is going to give you some insight into your business. And it's just important that you try to gain some benefit out of every modeling exercise. So as a final slide, I just wanted to sort of leave you with my perspective on what the actuary's role is. When I first started getting involved in the predictive analytics at Utica, I thought my role was to build models. I mean, that's what we actuaries do. And it was part of my role. But really what I found was that the actuary's role is changing, and really they're expecting the actuary to develop an entire predictive analytic culture, working with the underwriters and marketers hand in hand, more so than really the actuaries have had to do in the past. I know in my personal experience, just going out to the regions and doing the training initiative was probably the first time 90% of those folks had ever seen an actuary. And I didn't know if they actually thought we existed, if we were just a computer somewhere. So it was nice to get out there and get your face seen by them. And it really helps to develop a nice company culture. So with that, let's just, sorry.
Hey, quick question.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts as far as how to achieve the price differentiation you're talking about? Sometimes you'll do a skip up, how do you go about getting the extra premium on the high end and getting the big
business? Yeah. We're still struggling with that in some ways. First and foremost, what we had to do is evaluate what is the model telling us the range of pricing needs to be, and then what do we have with our current tiers and current schedule credits to get at. And now we may decide that we need pricing from minus 40 to plus 40, and we only have pricing from minus 30 to plus 30. So how do we get at those extremes? You know, a couple of things you can do is, one, you can make rate filings to gain new tiers. Some states will allow you to tier within a company, so you get a lot more flexibility. Some states will not, and you may need like a blank company in order to do that. You also may be able to make filings to increase your scheduled credit debit allowance, but again, some states don't even allow any scheduled credits or debits. So it's definitely a challenge. I think the other thing you need to do is look at your competition and what their pricing flexibility is. If your motto indicates that you need to go or you can go 40% below, say, a manual premium, but no one in the market has that premium, you know, that rating capability, then you might not need to go down that low as well. And on the upper deciles, you know, same thing. You know, you'd like to have the tiers in place to right price that business. Right now, we're sort of still in that soft market. We were not as concerned about the higher decile business right pricing because we knew if we gave them a price increase anyways, they're going to walk out the door. But as we go into a hard market, that's going to become an opportunity that we want to have those rating tiers in place to right price that high decile business. I think the market will probably handle the pricing at that point. Is that your question okay? On the commercial line side, which is really what I'm focused on here, I am not aware of any companies that actually use it in filings. Sort of the big benefit on the commercial line side is, of course, you do have this flexible tiering and flexible schedule of credits that you can use. So really, we've tried to handle it through our tiering and our schedule of credits. And really, I'd like to avoid filing this if I could, as I'm sure we all would. All right, well, thank you for your time, and I'll turn it over to Mo.
Sorry. I apologize for my voice. I think I left it at the craps table last night. So, bear with me. So I'm going to try to encapsulate a lot of the topics that Paul discussed around what we feel is a philosophy of really extending and deploying predictive analytics through a holistic enterprise view. And I think this approach takes on even greater significance and is much more profound in a soft market, because when companies were first exploring applying predictive analytics to solve underwriting and pricing problems, we were in a hard market. So a lot of the issues and challenges around implementation and strategies around how to deploy and use predictive analytics were often masked by, you know, the pricing that was available in a hard market. Now that we're in a soft market, I think what we're seeing is some of the implementation challenges and how companies really deploy predictive analytics across their enterprise and how they enable strategies around predictive analytics. You know, that's becoming a little more exposed now that we're operating in a soft market. So enterprise predictive modeling, you know, really goes beyond just taking a pure actuarial approach. It involves people, technology, and process, in addition to the sound predictive models. And we use the term sound similar to the way Paul used the term, you know, a good working model, you know, as opposed to the optimal model. You know, one way to offset some of the pricing pressures, you know, on the underwriting side is to extend predictive analytics across other applications within the enterprise, whether it's claims management, whether it's distribution channel management, loss control, marketing. There's a variety of ways that predictive analytics, and we'll get into an example later, that some of the same principles from an underwriting application and from a pricing application can be extended into other areas as well. And predictive modeling is also something that's not one and done. I mean, you don't just build a model, go through analyzing your historical data, produce your lift curves, and say, okay, fine, I have a model. I think as market conditions change, as your business strategies change, there's really two ways to handle how fluid your predictive modeling approach is. One is to have an infrastructure in place that gives you the ability to rapidly deploy new models. The other approach, which we'll spend some time on, is having an enterprise-wide business rule strategy. So you keep the applications that take you a lot of time and resources to develop being predictive models, and you set up a business rules framework that sits outside of the predictive model. So as market conditions change, and as you know, a price that you charged at one point is no longer widely accepted in the market, rather than go through the exercise of redeveloping, readjusting your predictive models, one way to do that is to offset that through a business rules platform. So the components of an enterprise-wide predictive model, technology, business intelligence, and integration. When predictive models were first being developed, the technology really didn't catch up to the predictive analytics. Most insurance companies were still operating on a mainframe environment. The concept of having predictive analytics fully integrated at the point of online quoting, to have predictive analytics support straight-through processing or streamlined renewals, didn't exist several years ago. But nowadays, I mean, the technology around policy administration systems, around business rules, around agency submission systems are equally as valuable as the underlying predictive analytics themselves. The art and the science is how do you merge those two together in a seamless manner to really afford to really integrate those in a seamless manner to maximize the benefits across multiple applications. I think defining your strategies, again, as soft market pressures come into play, as market conditions change, I mean, you need to have strategies that are designed in a manner that you can rapidly change them, whether it's defining what the optimal price is by decile, whether it's defining what the underwriting referral guidelines are. You need to define them in a manner that you can rapidly change them, you can rapidly monitor them, and align those with your corporate goals. So just a closer look at, we think, the core components, refreshing and building the models, I mean, that is, in many ways the DNA or the backbone of this end-to-end deployment of predictive analytics. The scoring engine, or really the underlying technology that encapsulates the model, I mean, whether you develop a model in SAS or SPSS or some other statistical tool, typically that doesn't lend itself from a technology standpoint to easily deploy those and integrate it with other business applications. So you need to define some type of technology and really have a mechanism in place to take, the underlying data of the models, the underlying variables, the underlying coefficients, and all the components of a model, and then how do you apply that and how do you deploy it in the manner so as data is being entered within an agency submission system or as data is being retrieved from your back-end data repositories that you can apply those attributes in a manner that gives you the ability to generate a score and a corresponding price or underwriting action. I mean, that's really the technology piece of that. And we spend a lot of time helping organizations, overcome that challenge because you have, one group, the actuarial and predictive analytics group, and their focus is to develop the optimal models. But, we're amazed how many times where the data or variables are selected in a model and you generate these optimal lift curves, and then when it comes to implementing it, it turns out that some of the data is not available in any of the new business submission screens. So at the point of scoring, so what do you do? Do you redesign your entire policy administration systems to capture this one data element? Or do you take an approach where you solicit feedback and you get input from multiple stakeholders as you're developing these models? And I think the same applies to external data sources, whether it's financial data, are now, you know, a lot of time is spent on demographic and behavioral data at the individual household level, you know, and that's great, and then that can generate new risk characteristics, and that can improve the degree of segmentation on your book. But beyond that, you have to think about how is that information going to be implemented, and how is that going to information be implemented to allow you to support real-time scoring. You know, do you have a brick that stores all this data, and then what are the logistics and the infrastructure to set that up as part of your data warehouse, or you know, do you you know, send a service where you send a stream of data to any one of these external data vendors, and you get back that information, and then you integrate that. So there's a lot of challenges around technology. I guess, you know, my point there is, as these models are being developed, those factors should be solicited at the point of model development, so you don't run into the challenges of having this great model and all these risk characteristics, and then have to go through all the IT obstacles and hurdles to be able to source that data and be able to implement it. The next two, or I would say in many ways, the next three, business implementation, change management, and strategy, I mean, those things go hand in hand. As you deploy predictive analytics, you know, not only from an underwriting application, but from a claims management standpoint, from a fraud detection or agency management, if your core operations or your business processes are still the same, then you're really not maximizing the benefit. I mean, having the underlying analytics without redefining your business processes, you know, really doesn't give you the opportunity to, you know, fully leverage the benefits of predictive analytics. So if you're going to define or if you're going to base certain criteria on a predictive model that says for policies with these risk characteristics or within this score range that those are going to be the policies to support straight through processing, well, that's going to have an impact on your business process. I mean, that's going to have an impact on how data is going to go through and not be touched by underwriters. It's also going to have an impact on, you know, determining what are the new referral criteria. If you're going to say if these are the X policies that are going to get passed through and not be touched by an underwriter, you know, then you're going to have this, you know, Y category, you know, that's going to determine which ones are going to be referrals. So change in processes results in change in job functions, and that has a change management implication, and it also has an implication from a strategy standpoint. So, again, it's really, I think that what we're seeing more and more is, I mean, these are not any things that are new, but it's how much do organizations focus on that, and how much do organizations, you know, pay attention to aligning all those, as opposed to just having these different functions operate in silos. Well, one group, you know, your job is to develop the best models, and from a purely statistical standpoint, you can achieve an optimal model. But if, you know, by definition, if a predictive model is built on historical data, and you see this great lift of negative 40 to plus 50. Well, you're really not going to achieve those benefits unless it's fully implemented from a technology standpoint, from a business process standpoint, and stakeholders at all levels of the organizations actually buy into the models, use it, embrace it, and it's integrated within their day-to-day job functions. I mean, only then is your predictive modeling investment going to yield a positive return. As part of some best practices, you know, across some core functions. So from an underwriting standpoint, improve pricing precision, improve objectivity, risk selection and risk avoidance, how you negotiate price with the agent. From a marketing, you know, how you target, I think one of Paul's slides was around non-renewals, you know, which, you know, what's the area that you target for non-renewals, retention, cross-selling opportunities. So rather than focus on monoline strategies or predictive analytics that are line of business specific, you know, develop predictive analytics or use predictive analytics to take more of an account view across multiple lines. Identify geographic and product expansion opportunities. So if you know the geographies and the zip codes that are profitable, why not take some of that insight for your agency appointment and your new marketing opportunities. recruiting of profitable producers. We'll get into that example. I mean, it's amazing the amount of information that's available when you're appointing a new agent, but seldom is that information ever used objectively by marketing departments to determine, you know, which producers are likely to, you know, to generate more profitable business. And what you see as a result is most insurance companies, you know, the loss ratios for agents that have been with the company less than 3 to 4 years is often 30 to 40% higher than, you know, agents that have been here in excess of 5 or 6 years. So predictive analytics can also be used to enhance the distribution channel management. I think around decision making, and I think that goes hand in hand with business rules. So there's a lot you can do to automate decision making and eliminate some of the manual or the subjectivity around decision making, whether it's around fraud detection, underwriting, react to market forces sooner, which is really, you know, the overall theme of this presentation, and information processing and just data governance from an organizational level. So I think just going into the next sections, we're just going to, you know, drill down briefly into each of those six components. So from a technology standpoint, you know, we think the insurance industry as a whole, you know, was a late adopter from a technology standpoint. And we think that technology in itself will be a competitive differentiator as predictive analytics has been several years ago. So how do you have a technology infrastructure in place that allows you to seamlessly deploy predictive analytics throughout your enterprise? And it's challenging in the sense that you have the group that develops predictive analytics, the actuarial and the statisticians that speak one language, and then you have the IT department, and it's their responsibility to deploy it and integrate that, and they speak another language. So, you know, it's coming together and having an infrastructure in place that allows you to translate the attributes of a predictive model developed in SAS and integrate that with your policy administration system in Java. You know, it seems simple enough, but, you know, we see most of the struggles, you know, happen in bridging those two together. So I think on a, you know, change management, I think not only in a soft market, but coupled with, you know, the historic things that we're experiencing just with the economy and the financial market is, you know, what does it mean from a people standpoint and from a change management standpoint? Going beyond just, you know, predictive analytics and how that changes job functions, just the market conditions in general are going to affect, you know, jobs, whether it's, you know, whether it's turnover, whether it's layoffs, whether it's new performance metrics, you know, higher, you know, production and volume goals, asking underwriters to do more. You know, there is going to be an impact, you know, from a people standpoint and from a change management standpoint. So, and it may not be the audience for this group, but, you know, the point there is, you know, don't ignore, you know, the people aspect of implementing and leveraging benefits from predictive analytics. So if you get all those to work and you do it right, then we have something like this, right? You have a back-end policy administration system. You have some type of technology that encapsulates your predictive models. You have reporting tools or business intelligence that allow you to monitor and measure whether your predictive analytics or your underlying strategy is working. You seamlessly integrate your external data sources. You have your business rules that define, you know, what's the price and the underwriting action, you know, that you're going to take based on that, and all that is presented in a seamless manner to the end user. And that's really the optimal goal of getting all these components to tie together. And I agree with Paul's point that, you know, as far as, you know, the changing role of the actuary, I mean, I think in all these core functions, you know, the actuarial department or the predictive analytics group that has developed the model, you know, should play a major role. I mean, you know, they should, you know, as business rules are being defined by the underwriting department, I mean, they have the opportunity to do what-if analysis and sensitivity analysis to say, do these rules make sense, and what are the potential benefits? from an external data source. Again, I mean, defining which of the external data sources an organization should invest in, how they should be sourced, you know, have an opportunity there. How the predictive models get implemented from a technology standpoint, clearly from defining the functional requirements and really serving as a liaison between, you know, these are the 40 or 50 variables in the model. This is how we ended up calculating some of these synthetic variables, and these are the specs for IT to develop that play an important role there. And from a reporting standpoint, you know, defining the performance, if predictive analytics represents a new way of doing business, then you really need to come up with new metrics. And Stacy will get into some of that as far as, you know, how you measure your business. Just looking at that, I know everyone's itching to get out of here. So I am too. So the next section is going beyond predictive models. And I'm going to go through these briefly just in the interest of time. So it's going, you know, one area is new applications. We talked about account modeling, claims, lead generation, fraud detection. Another one is new data sources. So psychographic, behavioral, demographic, you know, seems to be the next wave of data sources, you know, that are being used and contemplated and incorporated into predictive models. How they're deployed from a technology standpoint is another area that's getting a lot of interest. And where I think it's really going to take off is around this enterprise-wide business rules management. You know, I think as the market, you know, continues to suffer and the pressures increase, you know, there's going to be the need to deploy consistent decision-making, consistent application of predictive analytics, and consistent adjustment to pricing and underwriting strategies, and have technology in place to support some of that. So I touched on this briefly, so I'll just skip this. So, you know, one example around, you know, agency appointments, I mean, it's an area that, you know, that we're focusing on. So if you have, you know, let's say you have, you know, a brick of, you know, DNB data. Well, you know, that gives you every risk, you know, in the nation. So you have an opportunity to apply some type of model against that and determine, you know, which areas are more profitable than others. You know, as you're looking to appoint new agents, you also have their quote file. So you can take their quote file, you know, merge that up against a DNB brick and actually qualify and examine for the past 3 or 4 years, you know, what are the type or the quality of risks that this agent's been producing. And you could use that to come up with some type of relative index to determine, okay, over the next 3 to 5 years, you know, this agent will have, you know, will be more profitable or average or less profitable than the agents we have. And you could use that to make a go, no-go decision on appointing that agent, and you go. Or you could also use that, you know, to determine the type of leads that you generate, you know, or the type of volume that you that you generate with that agent. So you're actually extending predictive analytics from an underwriting and pricing standpoint and really attacking it from the distribution channel. So one way to improve the quality of risks that you're getting in is to apply predictive analytics and really do a better job of appointing better agents. And then the last section I'll talk about is just enterprise-wide business rules management. So you want to have some type of mechanism to adapt to market conditions and change strategy more rapidly. If as an organization most of your processes and decision make are manual, that makes it difficult. So an enterprise-wide business rules management strategy gives you the opportunity to define all your business rules across different operations, whether it's claims, whether it's underwriting, whether it's pricing, and automate those. And changing business rules that are structured in a table format that sit external to all your business applications, whether it's your claims management, whether it's your rating engine, whether it's your policy administration system, whether it's your underlying predictive analytics, it's much easier and much fluid to monitor and change your business rules than to change the underlying core applications itself. So if it takes, let's say, 6 months to develop a predictive model. You know, let's say for a commercial lines, you know, workers' comp, it takes 6 months to develop a predictive model, and you spent and you started the project 2 years ago. You've implemented it, you know, say in 2007, and now you're looking at, you know, that model, and you're realizing, well, it's not that effective because we built it on certain market conditions, and now we're seeing as the market is deteriorating, you know, the predictive model is not just proving to be effective. So what do you do? I mean, do you go through that 6-month exercise or, you know, or that 12-month exercise to redevelop your predictive models again and update the weights, only to come back 6 months to 12 months later to realize the market, you know, the market pressures are again dampening the lift curve? I mean, that could be one option, but it really doesn't support this concept of rapid deployment. So another option is to really have business rules that say, you know, that allow you to offset, you know, the overall relativities in your lift curve and give you the opportunity to adjust that and the corresponding pricing action. So that's really the concept of business rules. You know, cross-core applications, whether it's underlying claims or distribution channel, whether it's scoring, risk assessment, loss control, determining eligibility, pricing and tier assignment, from a claim standpoint, SIU referrals, reserve setting, litigation, you know, a single enterprise-wide business rules application, whether it's Blaze Advisor, PEGA rules, or ILOG, you know, gives you the opportunity to define your rules for multiple applications, many of which are supported by predictive analytics. You know, the message there is, you know, it's resource intensive to develop a predictive model, but rather than constantly redevelop and chase the external forces of the market, it's much easier to redefine your rules and business strategies outside of that and keep your predictive models intact. I think I'll, if my voice survives, I'll turn it over to Stacy and she'll talk about business intelligence.
As Paul said, I'm Stacy Peterson from Deloitte Consulting, and I'm going to talk to you about the use of business intelligence tools for predictive modeling in the soft market. In a soft market, we know companies are facing stronger market pressures and pressures to generate volume and retain profitable business. As a result, they need to pay closer attention to the performance of their predictive models, underlying rules, and pricing strategies. Implementing a business intelligence framework that supports the rapid access to key metrics enables organizations to analyze results and act on it. In a soft market, here are some key metrics to examine. Model performance, measuring model distribution from one model generation to another, are the distribution of variable values occurring as expected, and are the distribution of scores occurring as expected. Also, soft market pressures and impact, measuring difference between model indicated price and actual price, measuring the effectiveness of business rules, examining geographic trends, and measuring changes in the quality of the book. And general performance metrics with predictive modeling slices, new business hit ratio, retention rate, producer performance, and profitability by different segments. Implementing these enterprise-wide business intelligence frameworks with defined predictive analytics performance metrics allows companies to measure performance across core insurance functions. General performance metrics and monitoring contributes to ongoing measurement of predictive models and enables companies to identify when readjustments of business strategies and operations are necessary. These tools can also improve distribution management, the identification of market expansion and growth opportunities, and also in identification of profitable agents or territories to grow and improve relationships. Ongoing measurement of predictive models can also improve ease of business. For example, identifying non-predictive and unnecessary underwriting criteria could help streamline the underwriting process. A business intelligence framework affords the opportunity to evaluate the performance of models by different business segments. This allows the necessary due diligence to be performed before the model is implemented. In a soft market, it's even more critical to get these models right the first time. In this example, the company is able to look at the model results in three ways: 5 different premium size groups, 6 different regional offices, and different target markets. For any of these segments, the company can compare the model results and check for reasonability of the policy score distribution. The company knows that... If a company knows that their small business is typically more profitable than their large business, we would expect to see, like here, the more policies being in the first couple deciles and the gradual slope downward. The company can click through and see how the distribution changes as premium size increases. If we take a look at the target market, long-haul truckers are relatively worse than average. So we see more in the higher deciles. On the other hand, office professionals are typically more profitable, so you see more policies in the higher deciles here. You could also look at this number of policies, amount of premium, to give it more credibility. There are different ways to look at this in different segments of business that you can see. Legal entity type, industry of classes, agencies, cross-line information, there's a bunch of them. Paul, there's an arrow right down there.
Thanks. Now you're telling me.
What's that?
Here's another example of a report that would be used to evaluate model performance before a rollout. For each model variable, this type of report displays the average value across deciles. It's a really efficient way to be able to check every variable, much more than looking at numbers in an Excel spreadsheet. For example, if you scroll down to some of the credit variables, you'd expect to see the lower deciles, which are the best business, have a higher average credit score, like here, in a gradual slope downward. Same thing for DMV financial stress score. Other DMV criteria that are negative contributors, like number of slow payments, you see the opposite trend occur. A higher number of slow payments in the worst deciles. Same thing for loss, although you might not see so much of a gradual trend. You would expect that in the first few deciles there are a few losses, and then in the 8, 9, 10 range, you see where the losses are. In this type of report, you can compare different splits, too. So in this example, there's a premium slice, and you can compare the under 25, the small policies, with the over 25,000 larger policies. Generally, you'd see the same trend, but the magnitude might be different, like in this example. The higher policies have a higher average loss ratio. Companies should pay attention to this to make sure that it's in line with the knowledge of their business. While this and the previous example are especially important before implementation, these are also good ideas to monitor while the model is being used. If all of a sudden you see one of the variables with a flat average after 1 month, it's probably a data issue that you should look into. However, if this trend happens more gradually, it's probably just evidence that you should refresh your data or look into changing your business rules. So, once models are implemented with underwriting rules and pricing strategies, a business intelligence framework allows management quick access to key information to examine whether the pricing models are working and if their related underwriting decisions are effective. In this example of a report, you can see the distribution of average scores in a geographic level. In the larger map, which are the original 13 colonies, I don't know, the average quality is shown for each county. Green are good, red are bad. Yellow and orange are kind of in the middle there. Because each geographic county has a mixture of good and bad policies, most of these counties have a middle color here, showing a middle score. A robust mapping tool like this will even let you drill down to get the actual policies and the actual quality of the price of the policies. You can see that in the upper left up there with the New York metro area. Geographically, you could look at the quality or quantity of business for various segments here. If a problem exists, companies can drill down and examine the underlying issues in a region where it's happening. Maybe its prices are higher than the market accepts, or maybe the underwriting process makes it hard to book new business. So it's always interesting to look at your business in a geographic way to get the big picture. Also, you can see some of these areas where there's no policies at all. You might want to investigate why aren't you writing there, especially if it's in an area where there are a lot of good policies. After an enterprise-wide business intelligence framework has been implemented, an executive dashboard like this provides a central location for senior management to examine performance driven by predictive analytics across various metrics. You've made the investment to change the way you do business, and an executive dashboard provides the tool to determine if the business rules or pricing needs to be changed. In this dashboard, you can see that we have credit and debit usage by state, credit and debit matrix pricing by state also. You can do state or region or however the senior management wants to look at the business. Also, New York or deviation from recommended premium by state, overall book performance, the loss ratio, expense ratio, combined ratio, and leads hit ratio, new business production by state, and also net premium deviation by state. This is a selectable to give you more information. Obviously, there are a lot of other metrics that the company might be interested in. Retention, some information around brokers or agencies. It's really limitless what you can do, but it's always important to really drill down and see what's important to the senior management. So in today's competitive environment, combined with soft market pressures where predictive modeling is becoming a standard practice among carriers, an organization's ability to process and distribute their information faster than their competitors seems to be the way that leaders are becoming dominant. And that concludes my section here. Any questions on this?
Any other questions?
Sure. Which was that? This or this is Crystal Excelsius. Crystal Excelsius. Business objects could also be used.
Yeah, it's part of business objects' framework. Has been adjusted.
Yeah.
Any other questions? All right, well, thank you all for your time.
Thanks.